anger, sexual lust, the sorts of things that you experience when you're playing a video game.
All these concepts originated with Karl Marx.
I think we're transitioning really to a sort of a campaign podcast for Marty O'Donnell. I just want to get right into it. I've been reading so much about this. You said that you've got some like key background info for the listeners,
yeah.
The benefit of the listeners.
Yeah, we can come in with the really boring stuff, which is just about the district. I'm relatively familiar with this district because it is the congressional district is the Nevada's third congressional district, which is part of it has it's kind of a funny shaped one, but for decent reason, not for, you know, evil reasons necessarily. Pretty evenly divided between the two parties. It is a portion of the south part of Las Vegas, and then it has this sort of like big chunk of the border where like not a lot of people live. And it's been the reason why I'm familiar with it. Now, they redrew the district as they do every few years, depending on the state. I believe they redrew the district in 2016 or something like that. But even before then, it was a fairly sort of like even split between the two parties, and thus it is something of a bellwether district. So meaning it's basically not predicted, but it's voted with the winner for president. I think every single year since Bush's reelection in 2004. So it's this kind of like funky swing district that's currently represented by Democrat, which is what really makes the Marty O'Donnell story very interesting. I believe there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people in this primary, which means that everyone needs to get all your Bitcoins and send them to my Mr. Destiny, Mr. Halo himself.
Marty O'Donnell, of course, is the composer who worked on Halo and Destiny, and I believe created the quite famous Halo theme that, between you and me, kind of tricked everyone into thinking it was a much better game than it was, because that theme absolutely fucks.
Yeah,
and that is why AGAB unequivocally supports the campaign of Marty O'Donnell. I am just going to read his policy platform for the first time in a moment while taking a big sip of this cup of coffee. But carry on while I do that.
We would like to completely and 100% endorse his campaign. He will be the only campaign that we're endorsing for the entire election cycle. One Republican.
That's right.
A Republican who's running in a state that I've only driven through. Never actually even been there in any meaningful sense. I do have friends who work in Nevada state politics, so shout out to all of them. Shout out to my buddy Mark, who's a real Nevada state politics person, unlike me, an internet gadfly and a reformed campaign person in current ne'er-do-well. But yeah, there is a... my favorite fun fact is that one of his opponents is... I've been calling her Elizabeth Hegelian, even though her last name is Helgelian. I don't know how to fucking pronounce
okay.
it. But it looks a lot like Hegelian. Elizabeth Hegelian, I think, is one... I haven't looked at anyone's fundraising. I don't know if they've had to report... How often they have to report their fundraising in Nevada. But our guy Marty really needs everyone's help. He needs all your Bitcoins and all of your cryptos, all of your Doge coins, if that's still a thing, all of your AGAB bucks are exclusive cryptocurrency, because he's running against...
AGAB bucks, that's B-U-X, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, always. the X is like the Twitter X, for some reason. We're being sued because of that. That was why, is to provoke a lawsuit. No, he's running against people like Elizabeth Hegelian, who is, she used to be a state senator. The Nevada state treasurer, Dan Schwartz, is another one of his opponents. So Marty has, he really, now he has the Musk endorsement, you know, the most important of political endorsements from the guy.
Yeah, now that's a name you can trust.
That's right. Someone, I read this, I think it was a quote from More Perfect Union, where someone was, they had interviewed a former Tesla manager who described Elon Musk as a pigeon CEO. He comes in, shits all over everything, and then leaves, which I thought was really fucking funny. I was still thinking about that because that just made me laugh. So yeah, hopefully he can come in and shit all over Marty in a good way, and we can get him to Congress, because I need people to know about his he's like, so his platform is like, he's like a this kind of like new right people, where he talks about the oligarchy and, you know, like it's like vaguely gestures towards like corporate control of things and refuses to take PAC dollars and stuff like that, which is going to be really good. Yeah. It's going to be really good for him when he loses on principle. So I want to welcome him to the left wing by default.
Absolutely. He's got a lot to say about corporations. And he's really talked about standing up for regular working people. Hold the fort. He's talking a lot about securing the border.
Yeah.
Have you heard this?
Yeah. They always do that. They care a lot about border security and probably about pronouns too. That's usually they go hand in hand with each other.
I am happy to report that it took about 10 seconds on his Twitter to find him complaining about trans athletes.
Yeah. AGAP stays winning. We know everything. Yeah, I like his website because it looks like it has like vague like Starship Troopers kind of design, but with none of the, you know, critique of empire and irony, just purely like I'm the Halo guy, and I love how in his platform he has like potentially AI generated images of like, there's a, in his traditional values section, he has a table of people wearing spacesuits sitting at a table, a family.
That's traditional, yeah.
Yeah, traditional. Our sad reality is that many children in our country are suffering. Years of ridiculing and demeaning family values have taken a toll. No one has done that. No one's doing that in the United States. No one has ever demeaned family values in the past 150 years of the United States. So you're fine,
well,
Marty.
He makes a fascinating swerve, and this is, you know, this is kind of conservative stock behavior at this point.
Yeah.
But he in the Twitter post where he launches his campaign, he says, like, they the first half is always almost. I mean, the first half will be true. The first half will be a meaningful critique. Uh-huh. Right. So he talks about how the cost of food has risen at double the rate of the average household income, the cost of a home at six times the rate. And it's like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yep. Those are obvious, you know, indicators of this immense downward spiral for the past like fucking 20 odd years that we've just been living in. And then he says, well, it's because people have been, they've been mean about traditional family values is why that's happening.
Yeah, we can ensure
our children.
And
that's such a beautiful economic vision.
Yeah, we can ensure our children get the best start in life. Follow the science, as my liberal friends say. You don't have any friends, man. By supporting two-parent and kinship households that help love and nurture them. That's what's so funny about this sort of like the new... This is the language of the new right. We're going to see more and more of this. We've already seen it through guys like Josh Hawley. Senators like Josh Hawley and J.D. Vance have used this kind of language. The former has like pivoted toward labor and like working class language too, which is very interesting. But they have like... it's like, bro, no one in your district is talking about kinship, the rights of kinship. Like, and so there's got to be this line to where you have to have like here, Marty, I'm going to give you a little political advice, because I know you're listening and I know you're a fan of the show, of the communism video game podcast. And
he loves it.
You can't, like, I understand that this language is very popular with your however many Twitter followers, but no one in your district gives a shit about that. So if you want to win the primary, you need to, instead of talk about two-parent kinship households, you just need to talk about family values. Be more generic, be less that's all. I know it's groper shit. I know you have a foot in frog Twitter or what the fuck ever, if that's still a thing. The ones who haven't fully converted to the weird bits of the Bronze Age pervert, another fan of the podcast.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, we're also Baptists now or whatever. We're making the pivot with like the dime square fucking New York dork dickhead people, and we're super into ultra right Nietzschean interpretations of frog Twitter, like a normal person, very normal stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I just say that sentence you just said to people in my day-to-day life, and they're like, I totally know what that means, and you seem, like, normal and sane, and, like, you should be allowed near me ever.
Yeah, I'm winning all my converts to the, my far weird online, far-right ideology at my seasonal grass-cutting job, by... calling people friends, or whatever those people do. I think they need to play basketball with another human being, and that would maybe improve. I think maybe they would stop doing all of that if they could just like play one game of basketball with another human being and have a nice time. But I don't know. Now I'm speculating.
Stop posting about how Lolicon is not actual pedophilia, and pick up a ball. And you might find that your life improves dramatically immediately.
And when I meet any of these people, I do get very like, have you thought about picking up a sport? I get very like, hey, buddy, that's all that stuff is really interesting. Have you thought about baseball? It's the American pastime. You know.
Just something that makes you like engage with and cooperate with other human beings, even once a week. It'll do you a world of good.
Once a
honestly.
Week would be amazing. I think that would completely change their lives. I don't know.
It fucking would. It would. And you know what? You might make a friend who is normal, and they'll be like, yo, mate, want to go and grab a pint and talk about not whatever insane online thing you've been obsessing about for the past 3 years? And then you'll just feel this like wave of being a real human being wash over you. And it'll change your life for the better.
Yeah, remember like talking to your friends at the pub about going to the movies, and then getting a drink, and then talking about the movie that you saw.
Let's not encourage that. Actually, I've seen these guys talk about movies.
Well, yeah, but like I mean, in, like you had like be normal for 4 hours. And do something
yeah, I know
regular.
You've made note. I know you've made note of how many women and how many black people are in the movie, but don't present that to your new friends. Keep that one under your hat.
Yeah,
and see how it goes. Maybe try that strategy.
Maybe something that's not made for children. Try not getting mad at something made for children, and instead watching something made for adults. Instead, you know, like a movie that's based off of a novel. I don't know, a comedy. Those are movies. I am on a movie podcast, so we're merging even more the gamer and movie content here by telling people to go outside or get a job. Maybe get a job. You don't have to. You know, I'm not you know one of those guys, but you know, maybe get a job. That might help.
Working is such an interesting thing because, I mean, mostly it's a hellish experience, yes. But also if you can tell when you're interacting with someone who's never done it because it forces you to develop certain social skills and, frankly, coping skills that are so fucking important and some people just do not have, and it doesn't benefit them.
No.
That's why a lot of the... a lot of these incels are like neets and stuff. There's no moral value to working, but there is certainly a lot to be lost by never being forced to go outside.
Yeah, by never talking to another person or having to do something that you don't feel like doing.
And that's just one of the things that you know makes you have to do that.
There's a centrist version of this. I won't get into the details because I'm going on a different podcast to talk about it. But I had to listen to because I'm going on a bigger podcast to talk about Alex Garland's Civil War. I had to listen to Pod Save America because he did an interview with Pod Save America.
Oh my God!
Yeah, it was pretty brutal. It was worse actually than I expected it to be, which is saying a lot because I expected it to be pretty bad. But the thing that bothers me the most about a lot of different types of people, but especially the proud centrists, as Alex Garland refers to himself as, like he's like a 19 like the Lit Crit guy referred to him as a 1990s Lib Dem, which I thought was pretty funny and true, which even more deeply weird. But they're so proud of themselves for being normal that they just sat around and started complimenting themselves about how they have. Like, yeah, when I talk to my friends, I have friends who are Republicans. I have friends who voted for Donald Trump. And I'm just driving in the car and I'm just like, that's just being a normal person. Like, yeah, yeah. You know someone who doesn't agree with you on every single political issue. Yes, I too have been outside and talked to people before. Like, what the fuck are we like? But they're so proud of themselves, and I'm like, I may hate you more than the extremist weirdos. You're definitely more annoying in much more mundane ways. I don't know.
I haven't actually seen Civil War, but it's definitely something I'm gonna watch just like to suffer in the near future.
It's a deeply, all I'll say is that it is, as should have been expected, it is a well-made film that is deeply, deeply weird, very confused about its own politics, but everyone's already talked about that. And also, Alex Garland is a deeply stupid person. That's I think, well, I've come away from watching interviews with him, listening to interviews, and then watching his movie, is that he's a dumb guy who doesn't make dumb guy literature, right? He should be like, in a different world, he was born in the United States and he was directing Fast and Furious movies or something like that. I feel just because he just has the spirit of like a dumb guy, and I love dumb guy literature. Sure. It's some of my favorite stuff, but
absolutely.
He's just had like, I think what I want people to know about Alex Garland is that what he demonstrates is that if you have the slightest amount, a slightly decent artistic eye, and the most confidence that any person can have in what you're doing, you can make good movies. Just have a little bit of talent and the most confidence that anyone could ever have in what they're doing, even when you clearly don't understand what you're trying to say. Just be confident, and you could probably make art that will, like, it's the number one movie at the box office right now. So,
oh, really?
I believe so. I believe it's A24's biggest hit.
See, now I'm a little bit salty about that because they've put out some fucking bangers.
Yeah, I mean, it's an indie production company. They've put out some shit and they've put out some really good stuff. They're a company. Like they're not A24 is not a human, and that human is not your friend. They're a production company. That makes indie
movies. A lot of people seem to think A24 makes the movies.
Yes, they do. They don't. Yeah, that is exactly right. I think a lot of people do, and they're like, "Oh, this is so A24." I'm like, because they put it out. It's just one of those things. Speaking of A24, Horror Vanguard is trying to get a hold of A24 so we can get screeners. So if you're affiliated with A24, I'm trying to find a fucking email address so I can get some screeners for some things for the goddamn horror movie podcast. So DM me. I know you're listening. Again, everyone listens to this show.
Yeah, this is, I mean, what else are they going to listen to? There's no other podcast.
That's right.
This is the podcast.
The first and only.
We single-handedly obsoleted radio. So what else are you going to listen to, dickhead? Yeah, no, A24 puts out some really dubious shit, but also a couple movies that are some of my favorites in the past few years. And they did say last year that they were going to pivot towards kind of like bigger budget productions. And so I'm assuming we're not going to... They're not gonna be host to Robert Eggers making his next weird little thing because he said he doesn't want to do a big budget movie again.
Yeah,
so they're fucking dead to me.
I think he was maybe their like he was one of their big. I mean, they've always liked Garland. The Ex Machina was, I think.
Oh yeah, that was them, wasn't it?
I believe so. Yeah, but and then they're yeah. I mean they're big. I think after Everything Everywhere All at Once, which I thought was I did think actually I finally saw. And I thought it was very good. I was actually surprised by, I'm not gonna lie. I avoided watching Everything Everywhere All at Once for a while, not for any particular reason, just cause I didn't feel like it.
Yeah.
So I didn't know, I knew that I assumed that it was like an Oscar comedy, right? The Oscars these days, everything that's nominated in comedy, it's actually a dramedy. And then some of it is, just straight dramas. I didn't know that it was as funny and goofy as it was. I think that pleasant surprise is what sold me. But I don't know. I'm looking at their movies. Jesus Christ, the third movie they put up was Spring Breakers and then The Bling Ring. Were the third and fourth films, and those are I love both of those movies quite a bit actually.
Can I say on Everything Everywhere All at Once, I really liked it, and I think that a lot of the response to it was kind of frustrating. I kind of understand some people who were annoyed with it because they felt it was too, like, kind of saccharine. I don't necessarily agree, but, like, that's a fine reason to not like a movie, I maintain. But a lot of people were upset at it because they were like, oh, they're just making a Marvel movie, and I don't think they're... The whole premise of the thing is that it's deconstructing the most popular trend in film right now.
Yeah.
It's such a weird thing to levy that critique. Be like, oh, you're satiring a popular thing in this way. Therefore you're just doing the popular thing. Like
I wish Marvel
that to
could
me
make
seems like a dog shit
movies.
Analysis. Yeah, like I think it's perfectly reasonable to pose the question, what if Marvel made a good movie? See what that's like. Like, that's... Why not, you know?
Yeah, like, you can...
Why not
can,
engage with that crazy thought experiment?
I know, right? You can actually, like... You can do an expedition... You can do an in-universe sort of dump of how, like, the sort of, like... silly physics work and it can actually be funny and kind of goofy, and then you can kind of break all of your own rules. You can explain things away in a way that's actually fun and not very annoying. I don't know, try harder, cry
yeah,
more, etc.
So we've gathered here today, unless there's more you want to say about our endorsed congressional candidate, Marty O'Donnell.
No, we just love you, Marty. Keep on keeping on, buddy.
I love that how much he's trying to ride the branding of being the Halo composer into a political career. It's not going to work.
It's all he has, man.
Oh, fuck yeah. Speaking of video games... We've gathered here today to discuss none other than the Fallout TV show video game. We're going to crawl out through the Fallout to talk about the adventures of a bug woman and regular looking Walton Goggins. Or is it Walter Goggins? I can't remember his name now. I nailed it. Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, Mr. Vice Principals, Mr. Righteous Gemstones, National Treasure, Walton Goggins. Love that man. He is.
Yeah. So I came into this with an incredibly, incredibly low expectation because it's a fucking Fallout TV adaptation on Amazon Prime. But there was a couple little nuggets of possibility. It's being made by Jonathan Nolan, who made the first season of Westworld, which I think is phenomenal television. However, I believe he went on to make all the subsequent seasons of Westworld.
Which are the opposite,
so,
yes.
Kind of a mixed bag. I can't say his name on something is necessarily any kind of good sign. I think I said to you before watching it that a funny outcome here would be if it's at, because people started saying that it's really good. I don't think I would go that far, but I was saying that a funny outcome would be if this continued the trend of whenever this property is taken out of the hands of Bethesda writers, they just seem to have a much stronger grasp of like the political commentary of mm-hmm. Fallout. And I think that is absolutely the case here as well. What did you think of Fallout, the TV show, the video game?
I thought it was pretty good. I completely agree. I like that you said Bethesda writers, because that's basically the note that I wrote down, which is that, wow, it's amazing what you can do with the Fallout universe when you know how to write it. I thought...
Yeah.
In terms of, like, as a... I thought it... if you're a fan of the series, if you're a fan of... Mr. Howard and his infinite supply of leather jackets, I think there is not only enough fan service for you, but there is enough good things to offset some of the sort of like Fallout tropics that emerge a little bit throughout it. They're used in a way that, like, it's a good show. It's well made. It starts off a little slow, but it it's pretty promising from the beginning, because the aforementioned Bug Woman gives a great performance, as does it immediately talks about having sex with your cousin within about 10 minutes. I thought that was really great.
Yeah.
I could fix him. The said cousin, I could fix him. There are several men in there are several men in this show that I could fix. And they kind of look like normal human beings, but they're all very good looking too. But the performances are good. I really enjoyed it. I just, it's pretty good.
So there's a thing about men in this TV show that's been bothering me. There's a few of them where the actor seems dramatically older than the character. One is, the main character's, I believe, younger brother. He's quite a short guy. And they kind of play like he's maybe like late teens, early 20s. Like, he seems like a young adult, but the man playing him is obviously nearly 40. And it's really fucking weird. I don't know if that stood out to you at all.
Yeah. Moises, I can't remember. He is 30. He's 30 years old.
He's 30 years old. All right. I felt like he looked older than 30. But... Yeah, but his character is not a 30-year-old.
No,
you know,
not.
And I found that really strange, and that would have been fine on its own, but then I think it was maybe even more dramatic with, his name's not Magnus, Christ. Maximus, that's it. Maximus, the Brotherhood of Steel squire, who is kind of like the second lead. The actor playing him is like 35, and he is explicitly like, this is like a 17-year-old. This guy is really young. He's really inexperienced. He doesn't know what sex is. And I think that's a very funny, in a way, it's a funny commentary on like the weird stunting environment of the Brotherhood of Steel. But it also does mean that it's this very unsettling experience of watching a grown man older than myself, kind of acting like a child.
Yeah, the actor Aaron Moten and I are the exact same age. And yeah, I think that there was this kind of like odd dynamic there. Especially since I think it's actually partially a testament to the way that the actors played the characters, because I think they played them as written very well. But then there was this kind of like disconnect between their appearance and their performance. He was Aaron Mountain was very good in the HBO miniseries The Night Of, which I think is the only thing that I've seen him in besides this. I thought he was great in that. The politics of the Fallout games are extreme. As we talked about in previous episodes, and when it's done well, it's like in the first two games, it's very clear. It really understands its own messaging. The show, it's very cliche about it. It kind of hits you over the head with it a lot, especially at the very end. But I actually thought that it did it in a way to where, like, okay, this is explaining the sort of dynamic, the very, like, not to jump to the very end of the series, so I guess spoilers, but the sort of, like, very final sequence where you're juxtaposing the quintessential end of the Fallout. Two large factions are fighting with each other, in this case, the New California Republic, who are introduced in the beginning and then kind of sit in the background and then get reintroduced at the end, clearly setting up for another season, and the Brotherhood of Steel. During this, Kyle MacLachlan, who is also great, as he always is, because he's perfect, is doing a monologue about the fascism of radical centrism. The problem is factionalism. It's very Alex Garland, funny enough. I'm definitely going to be making that comparison on the other podcast. But this idea that, like, the problem are the factions, aka all of those people, and the true solution is locking yourself in a vault. The true solution is the implicit violence of of perceived liberal democracy or projected liberal democracy, to the problem of people actually having beliefs and aims and fighting and making an effort to put those beliefs and those aims. In this case, militant fascism versus liberal imperialism. In the case of, respectively, the Brotherhood and the NCR. And during that monologue, he sort of reveals kind of like the heart of Fallout's politics, what makes the Fallout series good. I think the big takeaway that I had from this is that I saw that they were talking about how Fallout 4 is the game that everyone is buying after having seen the show. And
foolish.
Yeah, wrong. The thing that you should do is you should not look up a bunch of information about Fallout 1 and 2, and you should go to Steam. They go on sale all the time for a couple bucks, and you should get Fallout and Fallout 2, not look up stuff about it, and just play those games. And really because that's the best thing. I think, like, Fallout 2 is amazing. I like the original too. I have a lot of nostalgia for it, for its difficulty and for its, like, decision to basically never fully explain things to you. Its decision to put the tutorial 15 minutes into the game after not telling you what direction to walk in. I find all of that very refreshing in the sort of, like, I'm a big baby handholding that culture does for people and that I rant about on this podcast all the time. I think that's the real move. Is to go back, if you've played it, play it again. That's probably what I'm going to do when I actually have some free time, is I'm going to go back and play the first two games again, just because it's, the commentary is direct. It's very clear what they're trying to accomplish, and it's refreshing when it's, you know, the Fallout universe can still be informative and enlightening without beating you over the head with, like, contemporary commentary trying to, like, it's not trying to be everything. It's trying to it has a very clear aims and trying to state a political message, and I think that's good, and it's what made the show decent. They kind of understood what it was about, and yeah, like you said earlier, Kay, I also had very low expectations and was in several ways pleasantly surprised that they managed to do something with it, you know.
Yeah. Also, just to add on quickly to the idea of playing Fallout 1 and 2, which I also highly recommend. Some of us will be returning to New Vegas, including myself, after this show because they got that fucking itch. And I played Fallout 1 and 2 kind of recently. I highly recommend the Viva New Vegas mod list. If you follow their instructions, you will probably have a New Vegas that doesn't crash every fucking 20 minutes on PC, which is a fucking delight because the devil bastards at Bethesda are never going to give this like a stabilized re-release. Instead, they're going to give us a 50th Skyrim remaster or whatever the fuck. So we have to take the law into our own hands. I think that one of the best demonstrations of this show understanding what makes Fallout so kind of insightful but also fun politically was actually in the big kind of corny boardroom scene where Vault-Tec and like Mr. House and a couple other like big tech CEOs are there kind of deciding the plan for the vaults. And that's also the point where they go into the fact that Vault-Tec is kind of orchestrating the escalation of the war to nuclear armaments, which is funny enough. I made a Fallout video years and years ago, and I talk about how there was an unused film script that makes that same point, and some people got annoyed being like, that didn't get made, that's not canon. Well, suck my dick. It's in the TV show now. It's the exact same idea. because thematically, that is so much more meaningful than either China or the US kind of kicking it off. Obviously, this huge critique of like this fucking corporation profiteering off of the Cold War, it's way more meaningful for them to have kind of played a hand in it going hot. But in this scene, sitting around the boardroom, they do something I really love, and I think it flies in the face of Bethesda's approach quite a bit. Bethesda really fell in love with the vaults and the experiments, and I think if you had only played Fallout 3 and 4, you would think that Vault-Tec has some shadowy, unknowable kind of master plan that all these grotesque experiments are making up a part of.
Yeah.
But here in this boardroom, you see how fucking banal and stupid it is, because they're just like, we're obviously just superior people, so we're going to come up with vaults that will make better people to come colonize the surface. And immediately the guy's like, what if we don't give people enough resources and make them compete more in a vault? And it's just like the sort of stupid fucking things that like an Elon Musk would think of. Mm-hmm. It's genuinely unintelligent and incredibly powerful people just with their cold, hard reckon about what would probably make people better. And that is the thing behind the grotesquerie and inhumanity of these vault experiments. Not some shadowy, evil, genius scheme. Stupid fucks. And that, I think, is so perfectly like in line with the logic of Fallout, you know?
Yeah, market logic takes primacy. This very like it's good commentary on sort of our contemporary moment that has this mixture of productive forces that give rise to a certain social formation. That social formation has these kind of cultural twitches, if you will. It takes on this certain kind of like cultural character that kind of spits out into the world and then kind of turns into this feedback loop of productive force, social formation, cultural expression, and so on and so forth. It's the only way that it feels very, it's kind of dispensationalist. I can be a little bit of a dispensationalist when it comes to capitalism, but it has this quality of the supremacy of market logic that I find really compelling. And it's just like, it's competition. And they state it very plainly and very simply. And just as you said, it's very banal and matter of fact. And it is a bunch of assholes sitting around a table deciding the fate of humanity, but in such a way that's just like, what if there was an app that would give you the right amount of food? And just it like it's It's like, yeah, that's, it's not, a, it's not, it's really at its heart, it's not any more complicated than that. That's where the appeal to the market just kind of really comes from, and why, you know, and how, you know, and they've got some characters in there that are like, there's the middle manager who is like the friend of Walton Goggins' wife, who works for Vault-Tec, that kind of who is sort of like, it's another interesting part of the show. It talks about sort of like the role of technology and transition in cultural expression, right? You have the veterans of the war, the Alaskan War, clearly in this sort of like intellectual and cultural disagreement with the sort of middle management types that they interact with, because the shift toward products, as they describe it, culturally, away from like, Walton Goggins' character is a movie star. He's like a cowboy gunslinger type guy, in this very sort of like old Hollywood way, right? Like in like how there is some guy. It, you know, actually, what it reminded me of the most is, reminds me a lot of Hail Caesar. There's the character Twould that it ever toward be so simple, whatever his name is. He's just like a stunt guy who's very talented, and he turned out to like, it's actually, you know, it's who's, I think, kind of a analog to Gene Kelly's character in Singing in the Rain, who just kind of becomes, he becomes a movie star because he's good at stunts, and someone, they needed a stunt guy. And if you have a certain kind of a background and you have a certain kind of experience, like you grew up in Northern California, so you're Northeastern California is much more like Nevada. So there's a lot of fucking horses and stuff. So if you grew up riding horses, you know how to ride a horse, you could become a movie star. But now it's shifting away from this, like, you know, the market is shifting toward the creation and the curation of products as human beings. And that's interpreted and displayed through changes in the shifts in technology. And the shifts in technology are represented by the sort of like management types who are disconnected from the results of their, like, there's that conversation they have, I think, in like the seventh episode, where he's talking with that middle management guy about power armor, and he's like, oh yeah, I worked on the first model of the power armor or whatever, and he's like, yeah, I served with that power armor and a lot of people died because it sucked ass. And he's like,
yeah,
well, yeah, so now I kind of moved away from that, now I'm more into like logistics, blah blah blah. I don't even remember what he said, it's just corporate nonsense. And I found all of that, like, that commentary to be real crisp and clean and real. It really stated what it was trying to do, and like, I thought I really liked that part a lot too.
Yeah, and I loved making him be like the vault boy as well, and because something that there's a good friend of mine talks about a lot, she's really frustrated by the way Bethesda kind of just thinks the vault boy's neat. Where it's meant to be this pretty, like, grotesque sort of, like, this is Cold War era propaganda. This is the guy in the video that assures you if you just get under the table, you and your family will be safe in a nuclear blast. It's fine. And so doing the thing with the thumb was very funny. But that, it wasn't just that. It was the way that they kind of incorporate basically McCarthyism and the Red Scare into this in a way that, again, Bethesda wears the anti-communist, jingoistic aspects of the pre-war U.S. kind of like it's a funny sort of aesthetic.
Yeah,
but this is like, yeah, but this is like, no, this guy, like, the show he's on was being basically repurposed as fucking propaganda. They ousted the old director for not being like pro-U.S. enough. There's this constant, like, you know, weird, like, oh, I heard so-and-so was a communist, they're gone now, kind of just in the background whenever in all the pre-war stuff, which I thought was really interesting. I ever since 4, I've been iffy about them showing us before the bombs, because I really like it as something that we have to piece together based on what's left by the time the games are set.
Right.
And you know, it's almost like showing the horror, the monster in a horror movie too early, kind of, to just show it to us flat. But I, to be honest, I really liked a lot of what they did with it. I thought it was really interesting, and it all served their core kind of commentary really effectively.
Yeah, I agree. And you talked about at one point he's having a conversation with a like a movie director, which they do a lot of to, you know, sort of jump back into the nuts and bolts of it. They do a lot of really interesting camera work and a lot of interesting sort of like transitions from, you know, filming a commercial into that scene in the commercial, really sort of like standard movie stuff. But they just did it in a way that felt very like clean and very tasteful. At one point, they have these wide shots that really evoked the early games, in my opinion. I don't know if that was intentional, but they would use these wide shots of the main character, Lucy, as she's like moving through the wasteland, that felt sort of that felt like direct, like it felt like stuff that you didn't necessarily get in the later games, even in the parts of the later games that were good. I liked how that like kind of feeling of, you know, that really feeling of being very small, and being very over. It was nice. Like, I didn't feel like in the later games how it's doing everything. The game is doing everything it can to like not make you feel overwhelmed by your environment, which feels like the opposite. That's not the point. The point of moving from in the interior of a vault into this exterior environment is to make you feel like not, and the show did this really well too, like to feel like, you know, you actually don't know anything. The more you find out, the less you realize you know. This very sort of like human, very relatable idea. I don't remember what my last point was, but besides when he was having a conversation, at one point the director he was talking to was this South Asian gentleman with a beard. I could also fix him.
He
was only in one scene, but I'm like, wow.
Just kidding, I'm gonna make him worse.
But in a good way.
So something I want to talk about that has always been a bit of a an elephant in the room with Bethesda Fallout is their infatuation with the Brotherhood of Steel is so fucking annoying.
Yes.
And it's so limits them from having like new and interesting ideas. And I feel like this is somewhere where I can really feel Todd's hand in the show was the choice to, so some people kind of freaked out about like the canon or whatever. I don't really care about that shit. But they have clarified that Shady Sands, you know, we've already gone into spoilers, was blown up after the events of New Vegas, so that all still happened. But the thing about every non-Bethesda Fallout is that there's this element of rebuilding civilization and what that looks like and and thinking a lot about these competing ideas of how to not just make the same shit world from before. And that's kind of what makes the series great. But Bethesda really wants that pure wasteland. And so that felt very present to me with the choice to destroy Shady Sands and have the NCR. Either Jonathan Nolan or Todd Howard said that the NCR is still like doing well in other places, but not where we are, because that, you know, it borders on a state. You know, they've got their own currency. We can't. It's got to be bottle caps and like wasteland settlements and nothing else. Right. The choice to have the Brotherhood of Steel be quite prominent felt kind of annoying, because in New Vegas, what had happened is the NCR, by practicing like basic practical statecraft and not being like a weird little cult, they defeated the Brotherhood of Steel pretty soundly. Mm-hmm. And they got pushed back to like a single bunker. And this is a good sign for the wasteland. Like, the fact that something like the Brotherhood of Steel can't, like, the fact that they can't control that whole area because, like, something attempting to be civilization, and the NCR is dog shit in a million ways, obviously, yeah. But that is a sign of, like, higher levels of development than just, like, a few freaks with power armor. And Bethesda so clearly is like, no, get rid of that. Literally nuke that. More Brotherhood of Steel. I want Vertibirds. And that's a shame, because the Brotherhood of Steel is also sort of, I wanted to talk a bit about how the Brotherhood of Steel is in every game. It's different. Mm-hmm. In Fallout 1, it's this more insular, you know, we're centralized, or rather we're primarily concerned with, hoarding and protecting technology. Mm-hmm. When the super mutant threat starts up, we actually recede rather than expand. We stop taking in new recruits. In Fallout 2, they actually come out of their seclusion and become pretty prominent in the wasteland, only to get kind of complacent and, you know, get fucked over by the Enclave. And then after the Enclave is destroyed, they expand east. In Fallout 3, you get them being like, they justified it by saying it was like a splinter faction, but they just have nothing to do with the Brotherhood's goals. They're just playing at being knights, basically. Yeah. And then in 4, I actually kind of liked what they did in 4. They really explicitly leaned into the fascism. Mm-hmm. The Brotherhood is really, really all about hating non-humans, hating synths. But in every one of these games, the Brotherhood of Steel is kind of a different beast. It's always just kind of whatever they want it to be in that game. And likewise in this show, the Brotherhood of Steel just feels so different. There's always a bit of the religious element, I think, especially in the little insular bunker in New Vegas, but mm-hmm. I don't think we've ever seen it as explicitly like culty and fucking weird as we do in the show. And also the really directly like mimicking like the knight squire dynamic in this way is not actually really a thing that I think they tend to do. I don't know. Did you have any thoughts on the bizarre presentation of this kind of like religious fascist Brotherhood of Steel?
Yeah, I did. The thing that I took away from it was two things. One, I understand the logic of choosing the Brotherhood of Steel to make your focus in the TV show, because for the NCR, mostly what I imagine is, I feel like they didn't think that they could make a TV show about paperwork, which like when I imagine the NCR, it's like the difference is like the presence of bureaucracy. And that was a big part of the early Fallout games, right? Like Fallout 2, I think, especially. You really start to see like, oh, this is the dynamic of like exactly as you were describing, like what it means to try and quote unquote rebuild civilization, and everyone's competing sort of like cultural imagination for that. How the Brotherhood of Steel is often like this, it is a little messy across the various titles, and they have, you know, sort of like these little justifications for that. Splinter groups, insularity, or changes over time, you know, and like I get that, and I feel like in the TV show their attempts to kind of make a composite, was serving that purpose, that we have to overcome the limitations of starting out the show focusing on the NCR, which might not be nearly as exciting because you don't get the like you don't get the vertebrates and the power armor and like the flashy stuff, like you yeah. don't get the same, like it's harder to describe the subordinating impulses of liberal democracy than it is the subordinating impulses of militant far-right fascism, because you have just cleaner historical metaphors, because fascists, as we know, are unintelligent in their historical metaphors on purpose. It's about the sort of like the problem with the Brotherhood of Steel is often a problem of demonstrating a kind of historical fascism in film, because when you don't have the sort of like existing sort of like, again, quote unquote, civilizing discourses, that like you can't, like fascism can't be the same in a post-apocalyptic scenario unless you have this like really sort of like rich historical context, because fascism relies on abstracting and then recohering that same historical context in such a way that appeals to the impulses of a like the sort of like inner impulse of reviving something that never existed in the first place. German fascists did this by sort of imagining a pan-German identity that did not exist historically. But what they did is they sort of took that history and they broke it up and shattered it and then kind of rearranged it in a way that was useful for imagining what, like, how a person could try and fulfill this sort of like inner expression of, you know, German identity. In the case of like, and I talked about this on this show when I talk about why like pop stars' songs are fascist, which ones are fascist and which ones aren't. But like, I have this idea that I've talked about. A lot of them. I talked about it on Profane Illuminations too and on Horror Vanguard. This idea that like, I truly believe that the, self-fulfillment, self-help, you know, be yourself, find your true self, express that true self, that is extremely popular in American culture, not as much as it used to be, but that from like the, like that, it was one of the sort of like prime motivators in post 9/11, American culture needed to, what it needed to do was sort of after 9/11, smooth out its edges. There was the 90s, which had this sort of very, like, you know, like, all of the sort of, like, shattered and fragmented portions of neoliberal democracy could be cohered in this, like, you know, we can all come together and support the sort of, like, implied mission of the nation. It's the cheerleading movie Bring It On. Where the races all come together to be their best version of cheerleading, and everyone is happy at the end of it. It's Gladiator. These are those are my two sort of quintessential pre 9/11 cultural objects.
Is that what Bring It On is about? I have not seen that movie.
First of all, it's a great movie. There's a lot of homophobia in it. It's very funny. So if you think that, if you're like me and you think homophobic jokes are actually like really hilarious, which they just so often are, especially in this case, I recommend that. It made me laugh a lot. But if you're sensitive for when people used to use slurs in movies all the time, then maybe avoid it. I was alive and watching movies at that time. So now I watch it and I think it's very funny. Those cultural tendencies got changed a lot after 9/11, where like, okay, we have to come together and it has to be more explicitly nationalistic. The tension has to be removed. The tension is only between the exterior and the interior, right? The exterior is the scary terrorist bad. This existed in Cold War culture too, but, you know, sort of fell out of style for a little while when America's enemies were slightly less clear. So it needed to sort of like cohere its cultural imagination, and then that eventually had turned inward again in such a way to where now everyone is depressed about Iraq, and like everyone's depressed about politics, and everyone's depressed about the post-Obama years, and either trying to be like, no, this is all fine and good, you know, the beer summit was really a good thing and the banks getting bailed out and all that stuff, it's all good, and you know, even though America is getting richer and none of us are actually getting richer, it's actually fine because, well, I have self-empowerment, I can look inward and I can realize that I'm a firework, you know. It's all Katy Perry. You know, it's the Katy Perry Pikachu song. It's all of that stuff is, I think, very fascistic in its like appeal to an absolute identity, even if that identity is sort of spread across a bunch of like isolated individuals. It's about finding your quote unquote true self in order to, you know, do nationalism better. And like, that's the cultural impulses of liberal democracy. And that, like, see, that just took me like 6 minutes to describe. And I don't think I necessarily did the best job at it. And so, like, trying to illustrate that in a television show, I imagine, is not as easy as, like, you know, giant robots branding each, like, you know, this very sort of like, One thing that I think they did do well with the Brotherhood of Steel is they are like all, they might as well be castrati. They are completely sexless, but also masculinized in a lot of ways. There's a very good performance from a non-binary character. Which shows that it's not explicitly about gender. It's not explicitly masculinized. It's implicitly masculinized in the sort of, so like anyone of across any amount of gender representation can subsume themselves under the militaristic discourses that do rely on that masculine identity. But you can become, it's possible, it's all about subservience. You can become subservient to this idea. And what it does is it turns you into a fucking weirdo, because they're all really weird and very confused and are constantly bowing for no reason. I thought sort of like those little points, just as you were saying, the kind of like religious, fascist, militaristic stuff, I think, when they did that stuff, it may not have been perfect, and it may not have described the Brotherhood of Steel all that well, which can be very squishy across the Fallout series. But I understood the point that they were trying to make when they, your dick gets hard. When your dick gets hard and then it explodes and it's really scary.
that was so fucking good. Like,
it was honestly very funny.
Something that I kept wondering if it would come up, it never did, so this remains maybe a little headcanon, is because this version of the Brotherhood is a lot more like violent in its own ranks. Like, it seems like people are getting executed for like no reason. It seems like knights can just decide to kill their squire for like no fucking reason. And I also noticed that there's always been a bit of this, but it felt much heavier, the kind of Roman influence in names. Yeah. And I kept expecting them to suggest that maybe they had absorbed like the remnants of Caesar's Legion after the events of New Vegas, because that would explain a lot of those changes. I don't know if that's anything or if maybe they just took influence from them a bit. But this feels like a brotherhood stuff, this feels like a brotherhood that took a few pages from the Legion, and it does. I kind of like it. I like this version of the Brotherhood. If we're going to be fucking stuck endlessly having the Brotherhood be a major faction, even as it, you know, less and less makes sense for them to be, I do appreciate that they're willing to be kind of adventurous with it at the very least.
Yeah, the problem with the Fallout games is when they try and smooth out the edges instead of leaning in to all of the fucking weirdo goofballs that have been present. Like, they have so much material that they're able to use. And that's just sometimes it's just so like, it's just so, I mean, you know, not to bring it back to like the H-bomb videos, but like, it's just very like, whoa, look at that. It's a big robot that blows stuff up. It's like, and they, in an effort to like make loud, obnoxious video games, they can't use the loud, obnoxious stuff in a way that actually forwards the faction that they're trying to describe, but instead they flip it around and do the opposite. And I think the TV show, yet again, there we go again, like, put it in different writers' hands, and they can actually, at least they can take what they're working with and make something interesting out of it and use the kind of, the rocket's red glare of it, if you will, to try and explore what it means to be a military weirdo in a way that, like, at least, like, it's not answering all, like, it's a show that's, like, it knows what it's trying to say. It's not explicitly, just like the early games, it's not, like, it's about the conflict playing out, not about the answers that the game already has to that conflict. It's showing me, it's not telling me. And I get so sick of culture that just tells me everything. It's like, let me sit here and explain what all, who good, who bad, who do thing and who don't do thing and why, And it's like, no, you have to try harder than that. And yeah. They put in an effort in this TV show. Kudos to the writers for putting in an actual fucking effort.
Yeah, I think they did a good job of knowing what was worth pulling from the games and where they should kind of make their own calls. Like, I think that they did a good job pulling from kind of the direction Bethesda takes to Brotherhood and 4. And I hate 4 for a million reasons, but I was very pleased when the Brotherhood is led by some like annoying fucking undercut little fascist prick, and they're leaning into that side of what the Brotherhood is. And we're seeing this like aggressive expansionist Brotherhood, and that is what that would look like. They would have to develop hot new race sciences to justify their behavior. And so I don't think it is so much of a leap then from there to what we see in the show. And I think that's a sign that they kind of they saw those ideas about what the Brotherhood could be and saw things that they could work with. Before we scuttle behind the paywall, do you have any final things to say about the Fallout TV show video game book?
Pretty good video game television show book film video game. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening, all of the little nerds that listen to our show, love you. Have probably seen a good amount of it already, but if you haven't, it's actually worth your time. It looks cool. It is. I have become an absolute like terror when it comes to pacing in TV and movies, because I think almost everything is paced completely wrong. Everything is so drawn out and unnecessarily long, and just that I think it's a show that is. It's honestly well made. I had a good time watching it. A positive thing about Fallout and Agab, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, one day we'll have to do a New Vegas episode.
We still haven't, have we?
Yeah, I think we've done 3 and 4.
3, 4, or maybe we did 3, 4, and 76.
We like to 76. Shit on Todd Howard here. Oh yeah, that was the Todd's Inferno series. I remember that. Yeah, I am in 2 weeks. Two and a half. My dissertation is going to be in, and I'm going to have a modded New Vegas sitting there for me. I'm going to play the shit out of that, and then at some point we should do a New Vegas episode.
That's a good idea. We'll put it on the list.
Excellent. Stick it on the bill. That is going to be it in the peasant zone from us. But we're going to continue talking a bit about Fallout and whatever other TV, video game, graphic novel, VR experiences we've had behind the paywall. So give us your fucking money. We need it to buy Bitcoin to give to Marty O'Donnell. All right, Kyle, where can the good people at home find you?
You can find me crisping up like a lizard in the Florida sun for another week, and you can also find me now regularly on the Horror Vanguard podcast. If I can recommend one of the recent episodes, I think Flatliners is probably the best movie that we've watched. I will be taking credit for pitching that one as a movie that we should watch, and it was a great episode. But there are several on there. The bonus episode for last month was on Trucks, a made-for-TV adaptation of the Stephen King short story that originally inspired Maximum Overdrive. They made another movie about it. So yeah, you can find me there. Okay, what about you?
Can I just say, Horror Vanguard has been one of my favorite podcasts for ages, and having Kyle on it is like, what if you took a great thing and made it better? What a pitch. You should listen to that. If you don't listen to it, go listen to it. As for me, my video on Oppenheimer is finally out. Go watch it at youtube.gov.uk. I'm Kay and Skittles on there, as well as on Twitter, and there'll be a Linktree link for all the other assorted things. You can find my other podcast, you can find my channel, you can probably find like my national insurance number, my medical records, whatever you need. So until next time, This is Mr. New Vegas signing out.
Da, 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 da. All gamers are bastards. Ravioli. Ah, mamma mia.